Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. I'm delighted indeed to welcome Maura Mulligan. Maura, born in Ahamore in County Mayo. And she actually beat me by a few months in coming to America. And she's got a book, and it is it's doing extremely well on both sides of the Atlantic. It's called Call of the Lark, a memoir, and a beautiful story. Of course, in the Irish community, Maura, first of all, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Adrian. Delighted to be here.
Fáilte rud.
Gormina maga.
We have known you in the Irish American community for a lot of the years, and
since the 80s, I think. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And as a Gael Thor, as an Irish language teacher, as an Irish dance enthusiast teacher. And indeed, in many areas, we didn't think of you, mind you, as a gifted writer, and indeed, by virtue of some of the greatest writers in Ireland and indeed in America, including Peter Quinn and many others. Your writing and your talent for writing was a well-kept secret. When did you take the pen in hand?
Oh, I'm a late bloomer, Adrian. I started writing by accident in the 90s, actually.
Mm.
I went to Scolacla, Achill Island, where they have a music and dance week. They had 2 weeks back then.
Right.
And I went in the wrong week. I wanted to go to the dance workshop. So dance workshop was the next week. So I thought, well, as long as I'm here, I might as well do something. So I asked MacDara Woods, wonderful poet from Dublin,
mm-hmm.
who was leading the workshop, if I could sit in on his class. And he said, well, of course you can sit in, but you might as well try and write something while you're here. So I said, well, I've never written anything except for term papers for college and school lesson plans and that sort of thing. So he said, just go outside and relax and just listen and it will come. And I said, well, listen to what? And he said, well, don't listen to anything, just listen. And, well, I started thinking just very quietly about, excuse me, childhood memories and just my life, and I started putting thoughts together and writing just sentences and just bits and pieces. And I really, really enjoyed his workshop. And then when I went back to New York, I joined a writer's class there at the Y. And then it just took off. I didn't think of it as a book then. For mm-hmm. ages, for years, I didn't think of it as a book. I just thought I was enjoying the writing process. And then some people from my writing group said, you know, really, you should think of this as a book and start putting it together. So that's really how I began.
Right. Now, you've had many writings in the Irish Times, Irish American Magazine, the Irish Echo, Irish newspapers in general. So it wasn't exactly foreign to you. But if you would just kind of bring us to when you were there and you were listening and you were reflecting on your early days in Ahamore. Paint that picture for us.
Well, the writing about Ireland really wrote itself. it was very easy to do it. Somehow I could hear the voices. I could hear my mother speaking the way she always spoke. I could hear neighbors' voices. And so that really was not difficult to write. Once I started, it just sort of, like I say, it took off. It sort of wrote itself. The convent life was a bit more difficult to write. Mm-hmm. I had to think about it more carefully because it was more recent, of course. And
right.
I've always heard that childhood memories are easier to reflect upon and to come back to you. I didn't really know that, but it's true. It worked mm-hmm. for me for sure.
Tell us about the house, the family, the spuds, the farm, the background, and what you were thinking during that period of time in terms of immigrating or growing up.
Oh, well, you know, Adrian, I always knew that I was going to immigrate. I mean, it was what people did then. You either went to England or America.
Mm-hmm.
And I always heard that America was much better than England to go to. And I did have an uncle and a cousin here that I came to, as many Irish girls did in those days, and Irish boys as well, of course. Uh-huh. I always went to a relative. But when I was a small child, dibbling the spuds and watching my father harrow the ridges and then go off to England, he always just had to do that. He left us and went to England to work, as many small farmers did in those days.
Seasonal work.
Seasonal work, yes. And, of course, then when he came home, my mother got pregnant again. There was another child. So she had a very, very hard life. And
how many of you were there?
There were six, and I'm mm-hmm. the oldest of six. And so, you know, I often thought, well, I really wouldn't want this kind of a life for sure. So, and she always encouraged me to, sometimes it was confusing though. In one of the chapters you'll see that she praised a neighbor who had married a shopman. So
yes.
She would say, well, maybe if you're lucky, you might find the likes of him.
Mm.
But if you're not, you know, go off to America, and that's the place to go. And, you know, in those days, too, secondary education was not free.
Mm-hmm.
So I went off to work as a maid. Young girls went off to work in service.
Mm.
And my mother said,
housekeeping,
yes. You know, you'll learn from a better housekeeper and a more posh house what to do, and it'll stand to you when you go to America and that sort of thing. But I didn't stay long there. And then I went to work as a shop assistant. That was my second job. So there's a chapter in the book about that as well. But I think one of the chapters...
Was that a paying job, or were you, as the expression was at the time, serving your time, doing your internship, and if you got any monetary compensation, it was...
A pound a week. A pound a week. It was in those days, Adrian.
Yeah.
Yeah. So whether it was called serving your time or whatever it was called, it was enough to go to the pictures.
Yeah.
You know, that was all it was. And, of course, I was an avid dancer, and I, going to the dance class, it helped to do, the dance classes in those days were very cheap, of course, ninepence a class, but still, every ninepence and every shilling counted.
Yes.
So.
The dancing, was there dancing in your house, in the village,
Yeah, our house was one of the houses that the storytellers always came to. My grandfather was bilingual. He spoke Irish and English. He always spoke Irish to the cattle and the dog, and because my parents didn't speak Irish. And he always led the rosary in Irish at night.
Yes.
So before we went to bed, he always led the rosary. When he died, my father led the rosary, but he didn't. Then we had to switch to English. So I knew my prayers better in Irish than in English in those days, I guess. But dancing, No, there wasn't dancing in our house, though I found out after I came to America that my uncle was a good dancer. He was a Shannos dancer.
Yes.
My mother's brother.
Shannos.
Old style dancing, yeah. The looser kind of dancing where you don't have to stand so stiff and your hands are not down by your sides. It's a very fun form of dance, and it has come back again now. In fact, I just started taking a class myself in it.
Mm.
But I loved dancing, and I just had to go to a class. And Seamus Ford was a wonderful teacher. And his wife, Eleanor, came to my launch in Ahamore. It was a delight to see her. Mm. Yeah, he died a couple of years ago. So he wasn't, of course, there. But I think he was there in spirit because I talked about him and I showed a PowerPoint there and his picture. And his picture is in the book as well.
Now, you you had your eyes set on America. What was the procedure? Did you write to the uncle?
Yes, that was the procedure. You wrote to your uncle. In my case, I wrote to my Uncle Peck. And he said, well, now you can come by boat or you can come by plane, because planes were in already. But
just
I thought
about,
it would be like
a
holiday if I came by boat, so I came by boat. But as you'll see in the book, it was a rough trip for me. So, that's what you did. And then, of course, when you got enough money earned, you paid it back.
Absolutely.
So I paid him back, and then when I paid him back, I went home to save money further to go home for a visit.
Mm-hmm.
My visit before I entered the convent.
Right. When was that? How long before you made that visit?
I was 4 years in the country before I went. Then I went had enough to go home to visit, and then it would be 7 years again before I could go.
Right.
Because once I joined the convent, you couldn't go home for 7 years.
Mm. What order and how did you?
It was the Peekskill Franciscans,
mm-hmm.
and I.
Did they find you? Did you reach?
Well, actually, my sister Mag went ahead of me, even though she was a year younger. She came to America and she was only here about 2 months when she decided she was going into the convent. And there was always a lot of competition between the two of us, between Mag and myself, in our dancing lives mm-hmm. and as children. And I thought to myself, well, why? She has some nerve having a calling before me. Mm. I'm the oldest one. And, of course, it was a very noble thing to be called in those days.
Right.
And lots of people were either going into the Peace Corps or going into the convent or the seminary or... And so I first tried to stop her. I thought she was making a big mistake, and she was very new in the country. And but she went. It was her thing to do, and she went. And I saw how happy she was after a couple of years. Then I went as well. So that was humiliating for me that she was younger and had the calling before me.
Mm-hmm.
But as time went on,
you got over.
I got wise. Yes, it was a good step for me when I went in, as you'll see in the book. But when I left, it was also the right thing for me to do.
Were you familiar with convents in Ireland? Was there any?
No, I was not. I only went to a village school, 2-room schoolhouse.
Yeah.
And
the nearest. My convent to you probably would have been what?
Was Kalchama. Yeah, Kalchama.
St.
Louis and Kalchama. I did go to school there for a couple of months only.
Yes.
And then I decided it was time for me to go out to work as a servant.
Yes.
So I think I think my mother let me decide by myself. She didn't pressure me one way or another about what to do. In retrospect, of course, I wish she had insisted that I continue in school.
Yeah.
But she didn't. Whatever I wanted to do, I did. Mm. And that's what I did.
Now, there was the added attraction, though, which maybe in the subconscious, you joined a convent. You were going to get an education. You were for most of the convents, that education would lead to either a teaching profession or a healthcare type profession. Either one, which would be very noble and very...
Exactly,
very
and
good.
They were both... the community that I had entered, the Franciscans, did both. They took care of children from broken homes.
Mm-hmm.
They were wards of the court, and they were placed in the Franciscan sisters' care until the parents were allowed to take them home,
right.
Or until they were fostered. So mm-hmm. I did work with those children for a while. And also there were schools in New Jersey and New York, which I taught in for years and got my BA while I was in the convent. And then, of course, when I left, I was able to get a master's.
My guest friend is Maura Mulligan, and she has a new book. It's actually a memoir, her own, and it's called Call of the Lark. So you're in the convent, and at what point did you get the feeling that you know, that there was a lot of let me rephrase it. How did you find that the convent life was suitable initially, that it really had was it up to your expectations? Was it...
Well, you know, I didn't have any expectations at all, except that I wanted to become holy.
Mm.
That's all I knew. And in the novitiate, it was a crazy place, in a way, because the main thing was custody of the eyes.
Mm.
Well, the mistress used to say, custody of the eyes, sisters. If you maintain custody of the eyes, you will become holy. Well, all she meant was, you know, don't be looking around, look straight ahead. And it was all very exterior. We were supposed to learn how to meditate. And they didn't teach us how to meditate. You were supposed to sort of figure it out all by yourself. And learning the Latin prayers and all of that was interesting. It was when I went out to work in the community and learned... and, you know, got my degree that I felt mm-hmm. good about myself, that I was doing this work. But then when Vatican II came about, we were much freer, and we were encouraged to learn more about ourselves and see if this indeed was the best thing for us and so on and so forth. So I did realize that I had had enough, that this was it, that there is such a thing as a partial vocation, even though I already did have final vows
mm-hmm.
and I had to write to Rome to get my permission to leave. Mm. I realized that it was the best thing for me. I wanted to be freer, and I wanted to dance again, and I wanted to go on and do other things.
Right.
So
how was that before you... You've taken your final vows, and maybe it's worth explaining that final vows is really self-descriptive.
Yes,
that's
exactly.
It.
Yes,
that's
it.
And there is, to this day, there is no single word to describe... you know, what the equivalent might be in a marriage, like divorce or something.
Exactly.
Final vows are final vows, and nobody has made it easy to release yourself from those vows. It's difficult for nuns. It's very difficult for priests. If anything, it's even more difficult for sisters, for nuns, because you're kind of left there to your own devices, number one, and you're absolutely bucking the system. I mean, you are looking to extract yourself while you're still living in the house, while you still have been indoctrinated into. And the guilt factor with respect to here you are, you have, you've had an education, you've really, you're in an awful lot better shape and in a position in your life than you would have been had you not got in. Did that cost you some restless nights?
Well, I think it is like getting a divorce in a way, because you're comfortable, really. You have everything you need, and you don't have to wonder about where the next meal is coming from and so on. So it takes bravery to leave the convent.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, Vatican II was making it easier, of course. People were going into therapy, which is what I did to make sure that I was making the right decision.
What therapy was available?
Well, all sorts of therapy. In the beginning, when I first started, I went to a priest therapist, and then he encouraged me to go to a lay person, mm-hmm. a lay woman, and it's all in the book. And there was individual therapy and group therapy, both recommended,
mm.
and it was very helpful.
How long were you in the convent at that point?
16 years.
Mm-hmm.
I gave it a good shot. So you were talking about guilt. Well, I didn't feel any guilt at that point because I felt that...
Because you're from Mahamor and you're a male woman.
I don't know. I didn't feel it because I felt that I had given a lot of my life and it was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like when people get divorced and it's time for them to get divorced and they know that they have given each other whatever they could,
sure.
and then it's time for you to move on. I also felt it was time for me to move on. So the guilt factor didn't come into it, but what did come in was I was petrified of money.
Mm-hmm.
I was petrified to go into a bank and open an account. There's a whole chapter on opening an account in the bank.
Mm.
I couldn't believe how scared I was. And because when I worked for the phone company, they cashed the check right there in their office.
Right.
And
now that was, we will touch briefly on that.
Yeah.
You were actually working in the telephone company as many girls who immigrated. Matter of fact, that was sold, on the premise that this was a secure job, that this was a pensionable job, and that this was a respectable job, and it would be something that, would bring a great amount of satisfaction to parents and family. It had this, whether it was true or not, it had this image of being, secure, safe, all of the good things, that one at that time would have associated. When you were working for the telephone company, great. It was a lovely job.
Yeah. I worked for 4 years for the telephone company, and I loved it. I even won Miss Voice and Courtesy. They had a competition called Miss Voice and Courtesy. And if customers called in and said you had a nice voice and said you were pleasant to them and so on, you kept getting these awards. And so then there was a competition and so on. So that was very pleasant. Yes, but as I was saying, I got paid by the telephone company.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a desk right there where you could cash your check.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I would send some of it home,
mm-hmm.
spend some of it on the dancing, and then buy some new clothes. And as soon as I got it, it was gone. And so I wasn't used to money. And
yeah.
I came out of the convent, and I had my own check from St. Ignatius Loyola School on Park Avenue and 84th Street, which is where I started working after I came out. I didn't know what to do with it. I knew I had to pay the rent with it because I had got an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And I also had to buy food. And so I had to deposited somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very scary.
Can we just go back to that 4 years before you entered the convent?
Sure.
Had you frequented places like, you know, and I was only a year behind you, like the Jaeger House, like the Irish dance halls. What was your social
city center? That was city my place. Loved city center.
Yeah,
with
you
Brendan
were
Ward
absolutely.
And Paddy
Noonan.
Paddy Noonan. Yeah, they were the ones there.
You were the opposite ones. Had you come up to me up in the Jaeger House? You know, which was
rough and ready. I heard
rough and ready, and that's about the nicest thing. It used to be referred to affectionately as the bucket of blood. Which is very descriptive, and that's it. But and actually, just on that matter, they did.
Yeah.
They had differences of opinion.
I see. Yes.
Anyway, so you had done, you know, you were in that social atmosphere. I know that at that period of time, for all of us, we didn't realize that there were this number of Irish people in our own age group, from our own backgrounds and so forth, that could be, you know, that you could pack into one place, and it was had to be very uplifting, right?
It was wonderful.
And particularly you, because you like to dance. It was in that was part of you.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I made friends, and would stay over at someone else's house if it was too far to go back to Elmhurst, where I was living with my cousin. And sometimes stay over with a friend in the Bronx, and we'd go together to city center. And
was there romance?
Oh yes, there was romance, but I left him.
Yes.
He didn't like it. Yes, and he even came.
Did he think it was an excuse? And you say, "I think I'm going to go on the con," but that's not a high form, you know, of compliments to a male suitor.
I know, and it seemed like someone he had met before me also wanted to go into the convent, because I remember he was complaining, saying, why do all the good-looking girls want to go into a convent?
Right.
So, I just thought I had to do this, because I felt this call that I thought was the call, and so I had to do it. And you had
your sister Meg. Now, where was she at this? Meg, where was she at this point?
She was in Peekskill. I had been visiting her in her postulancy and her noviceship, and watched her bloom. What I thought was blooming, anyway. But it turned out later on, as you see in the book, that there's a lot of sadness with Meg. But I won't go into it here, so people will buy the book and wonder what it's all about.
Good for you.
Yeah.
There's the aha more coming out.
The aha more is coming out, I know.
Okay, so you made the break. You're out of the convent, and obviously the adjustment. And this might be a good time, actually, for me to mention that your story is, indeed, has tremendous similarities to my own sister, who is 13 years in the convent, and before she came out, sadly she passed away last year, but she'd been 13 years with the St. Louis convent, St. Louis nuns.
Yeah.
And then, you know, through Monaghan and where the mother house was, but she spent her time in Ireland going from one convent to the other. The transition has got to be, well, in my sister Irene's case, it would even have been more difficult, because she was, I don't want to say seconded, but she was in the convent at age 17 when, without any notion at all as to, you know, what the alternative life would have been. At least you had some experience in that area.
A little bit of romance,
I know, but not even on the romance, but also you knew what money was, you knew what, you know, what, how little or how far,
you know, that,
and so forth. But none of the circumstances make it that much better when, you know, you're out, you're on your own. The you now have to learn a new discipline, and nobody out there is about to sit you down and say this is the way it is, because they, you know, they're kind of they don't know themselves how much you know, how much you.
I know.
What the adjustment is like. How is the adjustment for you?
Well, in some ways easy, and in some ways. The money is, believe it or not, is still an issue. I never really learned how to save. I go back every summer to Ireland, and as soon as I have money, I spend it. And,
good,
you know,
for
I'm
you.
Still doing it that way. I don't know what's going to happen to me, you know, when I become really senior.
Shrouds don't have pockets. Don't worry about them.
Yeah.
But So now you're out, but apart from the money, how long would you say the adjustment period was? When did you say to yourself, you know, I've now copped on, for lack of, you know, I'm now a woman of the world. I now are independent. I'm independent. I can make my own decisions. How long did that take?
I don't know how to answer that exactly. I started making my decisions right away because the therapy helped. And it was really exciting, you know, to have an apartment and think that these rooms, these three rooms, are all mine and I don't have to share them with anyone.
Now, the therapy was provided by the...
The therapy was, the, yes, by the convent.
The convent.
They were wonderful.
And did they continue to...
My first year out, no. Well, once I got that letter from Rome, then it was all up to me. But the first year, it was called exclusteration, which meant that I was still really a nun. I still had the vows, but I could live by myself. I could practice how to deal with having a check and going into the bank.
Yeah.
But they paid for the therapy and for all doctors and anything that I needed for that first year. But I
wish I could say that about my own sister.
This was after Vatican II, of course. Yeah. Did she come out after Vatican II as well? What year did she come in?
She, roughly, it would be around 1970, I guess.
Yeah, so... Yes, because when my sister left, it was not as easy for her. She left before me, and that was before Vatican II started to come into its own, so to speak.
Yeah.
Because when she left, she left wearing the long habit, and she couldn't say goodbye. She couldn't say goodbye to me even, and it was dreadful. She left before I did, Magda, but she was sick, but that's all in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But... it was after Vatican II that it was much easier, and the order started to become more, shall we say, normal, well, just understanding of what a person goes through when they're living a life like that.
Yeah, the rule book had changed anyway, and it was, I think, by any standard, it was, you know, it was a major... advancement, and probably, you know, warts and all, it was still a great, you know, a great and much more humane
approach. That's the best word to use, yes. Absolutely.
Okay, so now you're out and raring to go. You're living in an apartment. There's no money in dancing, though the leggings are going like pell-mell. How... did you then pick it up from there? Where did you get the the energy and how did you handle that, saying, what I really want to do is dance, what I really want to do, you know, is flap my wings. I'm not going to be able to make a living out of dancing. This is for listeners to the program who are who became aware of dancing through Riverdance. This is about the exact opposite of that. Dancing, teaching dancing here was to a great degree that had become first of all, it was an art and a tremendous art, but you didn't show up one day and say, I'm a dance teacher, and you know, I'm making a living out of this.
Well, no, of course I wasn't making a living. It was the fun thing to do. What I did, the book ends, by the way, with my walking out the door of the convent. So this part that I'll talk about a little bit isn't in the book at all. But I did then get a master's degree and went to work in the public school system as a teacher, English as a second language.
Yes.
So I was at that time teaching Irish at the American Irish Historical Society. Uh-huh. And I was teaching dance just, where was I? I think I was at the Broadway Dance Center. And now I'm at Ripley Greer Studios teaching still Kaylee dancing, Kaylee and two-hand dancing. And it's just a fun thing. It keeps me in shape.
Yeah.
It keeps me fairly fit. And the people who come because they want to enjoy dancing and because they want a bit of exercise. So
let me just ask you, though. This is, this book takes us from, you know, your early days through life in the convent.
Exactly.
If somebody were to read through this, could they get a clue from you as to whether, in fact, some of this might be sour grapes, because eventually it came out with what are the different emotions that and reactions that you have to the book?
I have all positive. I feel that it was a good thing to write it. I didn't leave anything out. There was a lot of alcohol in my family too, and that's all described in the book. And I wanted people to know that it can kill, that alcohol can kill, and that's in there. There weren't, I think if you read what Peter Quinn said, there really is no sour grapes. That, I think a lot of Irish authors have done that in memoir. They have. Why there's been a lot of whinging and whining about their lives, but I don't regret anything really. I don't regret going into the convent, and I don't regret coming out. It's life has been good to me, and life has been difficult, and life has been pleasant, and life is the way life is.
That's so well thought, and indeed. Perhaps one of the reasons that this book is becoming the success that it is has to do with the fact that you tell it like it is. You're not, you're maybe in the rewrite somewhere along the way, you say, jeepers, I better not go there. But it's honest, and it is, I think it reaches right into the soul of those many who wouldn't have a clue even what convent life is or what what that entails. You should feel very good about the finished product. There's another book there lurking somewhere.
Thank you, Adrian.
Is there another one there?
Well,
on scraps of paper.
I'm working on stuff now. I'm working on fiction now, just for variety, and because now I can just make things up and just see what that feels like to make things up.
Well, there isn't much in this book I'm not much room for fiction, and I say, you know, those who are writers, and so many of them, you know, including the Larry Kerwins and many others, have given credit for what this book is. It must be a great experience to take a book, and a book about your life, and go back home. I mean, like you said, you've made trips every year and you're back and forth. To show up, you know, with your own book, which is being, critically acclaimed, are some people looking at you a little bit and saying, why didn't we know this part? Why didn't we delve? Why didn't you just come back and tell us bits and pieces? Because the leaving of convent, the leaving of any form of clerical life, is not something that's good for fireside chat, generally.
Mm-hmm.
Are you seeing when you come back, and when all of the people who have welcomed you and who have, are now supporting you, are some of these are people that you have actually, from Ackle to Tulshamaw to places that you've been, these are people who knew Amora Mulligan, without knowing or without guessing what kind of life you had and how you've handled it, all in a very positive fashion.
Mm.
Are they looking at you in a different light?
I don't know, Adrian. I really don't know. I haven't heard anything peculiar. One of my cousins disagrees with an issue in the first chapter.
Mm.
But I explained to him that it's my memory. It's the way I remembered, and it's what my mother told me. He said, this is not the way it is at all. This is,
right.
It wasn't this way. It was that way. And it's, you know, what his mother told him versus what my mother told me. So I'm the one
Absolutely.
Writing the book.
Well, you're lucky if it's only one.
Well, there may be others.
Because generally, there's
know.
Only, yeah.
Yes.
Generally, you only get one person who say, well, I don't know. I suppose most of it was, most of that's the way it was. But if you haven't isolated, you're lucky you're ahead already, you know?
Well, as my publisher said, most memoir writing disturbs somebody or other.
Right. And if it doesn't, is it enough too much?
Well, I don't know. I didn't want to hurt his feelings. It seemed I hurt his feelings terribly. That was not my aim at all.
All right. I just want to get past the book so that we can, so that you can tell us about the Maura Mulligan that we got to know. The dancing, the instruction, the teaching, the singular challenge that you had earlier in the game about flogging this language, the Irish language, which had for, decades been bandied around, mostly indeed, because one thing about the Irish, we definitely can, we're very good at bringing out negativity with respect to ourselves. That's a hidden talent. But dead language, don't bother with it. It's a waste of time. It's whatever. And despite the best efforts, the Gaelic language is still around, is still alive. And you take a look at the Irish studies across America and indeed around the world, and there it is.
It's
this is
growing.
The thing that many of us, have been fighting, even with ourselves. Like, I'm sure in your national school, your primary school, like mine, we learned everything Gaelic. I still can't have four single-digit numbers unless I do it in in Irish. Mm-hmm. But other than the catechism, everything else seemed to be like drilled into us through Irish.
With a cane as well.
Yeah.
The schoolmaster had a cane. Well, you know, when I left the convent, I went to the Irish Art Center in Manhattan. And I wanted to be in a dance class there or do mm-hmm. something with dancing anyway. So the minute they saw me, they put me to work as a teacher with dancing. And in those days, everybody was a volunteer. No teachers got paid or anything. But that was fine. I just loved being back in the culture. And as soon as the people heard I was from Mayo, they said, well, now you have to start teaching Irish. And I said, well, I don't know any. All I can remember is what I had in elementary school, you know, in primary school. So they said, well, you'll know more than what the people have here because they don't know any.
Mm.
So I found a book called Progress in Irish by Mairead Ní Graide, very old-fashioned book, but it had lessons. And I was literally one step ahead of the learners.
Mm-hmm.
And I told myself that, you know, now that I have a check coming in, I'll start saving, and I'll go back to Ireland, and I'll take a course in Connemara. And that's what I did. I went to
Carrow.
And Tí Wáchino Cáin there. And it was a lovely, lovely month program. Fabulous. And I did that 2 years in a row. And first when I went, put myself into the intermediate class and then advanced myself bit by bit. And then I felt more comfortable teaching at the Irish Arts Center. And from there, then I started doing my own stuff. And I first worked for the Cumann na Gaeilge at John Jay College and did a few,
absolutely.
I think about a year with them. And then I founded on Scoil Gaeilge and had that for 10 years. And I'm still doing it. I love it.
It's a great book, even if you're not from Mayo. It is one that, and the way I read books actually is something which I have divulged in the past. But I start somewhere in the middle and I work my way back and forth. And then, but the something about your book is that I said, I'm not going to get away with starting in the middle here or picking out any of the 20-some-odd chapters that you have here. There are a lot of short stories, short chapters,
yes,
but they're woven very masterfully.
That's what people are telling me. They like the flashbacks.
Yeah.
They like the flashbacks from convent life to Irish life. And I've been told that it works very well and that people like it. So I'm happy about that because that book had many drafts, I have to say. At first I wrote it just chronologically.
Yeah.
And I wrote it in a couple of different tenses and I kept changing it and kept foostering with it. And finally my writing group said to me, will you leave it alone and go and look for a publisher? So I left it alone and so there it is.
And the publisher, by the way? Is
Greenpoint Press.
Greenpoint Press. What is the website? How do we get the information?
Well, my website is mauramulligan.com, and I have all the info on my website, mauramulligan.com. You can order it through barnesandnoble.com, amazon.com, greenpointpress.com, or when I'm giving my talks. I have loads of talks lined up, especially in October. And I'm open for more, of course. So people sort of invite me to groups, Irish groups invite me to come in, read bits from the book and talk about it.
All right. And go to mauramulligan.com.
Yes.
You have the schedule.
Yes.
You have a lot of information on there. And friends, it is, you know, if Barnes & Noble think it's all right.
Yes.
Must be doing something right. I'm delighted to have you as a guest. And where did the hour go?
Is it an hour? Has it been an hour?
An hour.
Oh, my goodness.
Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network USA, Call of the Lark, a memoir by Maura Mulligan. Irish Radio Network, USA.